What we're going to do, at the request of the department, but one which I've very willingly agreed to, is have a quick briefing, even before we get to CA and AXA, on the state of play around the Road Accident Fund Amendments Bill. Members will remember that this has been something concerning us a great deal. And our colleagues from the Department of Transport will maybe introduce the topic that they wanted to table before us this morning, and then let's proceed. So, over to yourselves.
Thank you, Chair. It's a really simple call. At the previous session, we had actually made the presentations to the committee. The issue was raised regarding the consultation process of the regulation and the finalization of the Medicine Act and the regulation by the approval of the minister. Now, we have actually finalized that consultation process. And now we are actually at the point that we would like to get the approval of the minister for both the regulations and the Medicine Act. One of the hiccups, actually, and challenges that we are experiencing is the fact that, according to the federal advisory, we cannot table the regulations for approval and implementation prior to the provision of the verdict in the Morris Cooper case. According to a second legal opinion that we obtained, we may, however, consider taking the risk and actually proceed with the finalization and approval of the regulations, even prior to the finalization of that Morris Kruger. I would like to introduce to you Ashton Ball from the Cape Town Bar, and he would maybe just from a legal and technical point of view explain the case to us.
Wonderful, thanks for that. Okay, over to you then, Advocate Duval, and thanks for coming at short notice to the committee.
The opinion was not written by me, it's by Advocate Bill Trinder of SC and Stephen Butlander. I can make a summary of the opinion perhaps available if necessary later.
That would be Jeff Butlander or Stephen?
No, Stephen.
Okay, I assume there was something. Okay.
Yeah. The Morris Kruger matter concerns, as you may know, an attack that's of academic value now only. It is because the wrong provisions of the statute was mistakenly put into operation, the substantive provisions of the amendment bill was put into operation instead of the procedural ones. There was then an attack brought by Morris Kruger. That matter has been heard in the Constitutional Court in February. The outcome is expected soon. Advocate Trenger, however, and Advocate Butler advised us, and I'm slightly more optimistic than Dr. Quirtz, firmly advised us that the case does not stand in the way of the implementation and commencement of the bill as a whole. Whatever the outcome of the case, it does not stand in the way of the commencement of the bill as a whole. I don't want to go into the details of the opinion. I don't think that's necessary. I can make available perhaps a summary of it. But we received that advice, and I think normally government receives advice from the senior counsel and should follow them. That's why the department went in. I don't know, Dr. Quest, whether you wanted to talk about other issues at all, relating to the regulations, are now in final draft form. Perhaps, if there's any other questions, I mean, I could perhaps explain what the consultation process entailed and what is on the table at the moment as far as the assessment method is concerned. And
okay. I think let's for the moment hold it to the procedural issues and get a sense. It would be nice if we could see as a committee, if that's okay, the opinion.
Yeah.
I mean, not right now, but it would be useful for us to have that as a record. And thank you for that offer. I think then the question would be, what is to be gained by taking the risk, and what are the potential risks? I think that would be the nub of the issue from our perspective.
Yeah. As I understand the Kruger matter is that they say that Parliament, because the wrong provisions of the statute was put into force, Parliament should now go back.
So
I suppose the risk would be that there could be an interdict application brought in a court to prevent the commencement of the bill as a whole, because it's got to come back to Parliament. But the risk is really low, because even if a court would find that a fact is valid, what is likely to happen is that the order of invalidity would be suspended and it would be sent back to Parliament. And it's a highly procedural, technical attack. So I don't understand the risk to be very high, but I must stress that I didn't write the opinion. So.
Okay. I think what I'm asking is not what are the legal risks, but what are the time delay risks?
Of course, what we try to do with our regulations is to make sure that every T has been crossed and there's dots and all the I's, because what we fear is that the organized legal profession, personal injury lawyers, might launch an interdict application against the commencement of the regulations. Yes. So that, and once such an interdict has been granted, and one goes through the appeal process, one could look at the period of a year, perhaps, before the matter is finalized. But that's the real risk. And Advocate Chenga, as I understand, was asked specifically to advise on this issue of whether an interdict application can be brought against the commencement of the Act. And we advise, no, that will not succeed. So that is the potential risk. The downside is, if such an interdict application is brought successfully, we could look at a delay.
Okay, so what you're saying is the opinion is that it will not succeed, and therefore there won't be a delay. Not that even if it doesn't succeed, there will be a delay.
Yeah. If it succeeds, there could be a delay, but the opinion is that it will not succeed.
Okay. And then I suppose the question you can't necessarily answer, but I mean an informed opinion in terms of when, in any case, the Constitutional Court is likely. It's hard to say. In other words, is it even worth taking the risk if we're looking at a matter of weeks before the Constitutional Court produces?
I haven't read those statistics for some time. Yes. The average used to be 4 or 5 months.
Really?
But it should be. It's not a very complicated matter. It was argued within a few hours while we were there. So it shouldn't take a long time at all.
Okay. Do other committee members want to ask?
Chair, I understand all the delays in terms of might come about as a result of interdicts that would be enforced upon the department in this regard. But, you know, the question is that within those amendments, there are things that are uncontested, as I understand. Now, the question arises as to whether, as Parliament, this portfolio committee might not be able to go back and retract from those uncontested parts of the bill, aspects of which we can implement, so that we can get on, particularly with the capping and the foreign currency aspects of that that bill, or the foreign claims. Now, my question is that, you know, the de facto status of this thing as it stands at the moment makes all the board, as I understand it, also grim, because in that bill, there was amendments that affected the board, and the appointments have taken place. Now, what is the status of that? Have they got any teeth? Do they effectively exist, in legal sense of the word? Now, these are the complications I think we're not being addressing properly here. And I would like to know, despite, you know, all the opinions that might be coming out of our learned friends, Wingrove and Steve Butland, they've known to be wrong. And, you know, we could be questioned again, and, you know, dependent upon who's representing who here. Good lawyers, you know, in society today can change things. I would just like to know what the status of maybe taking out uncontested aspects by virtue of some, what do you call it when you repeal a bill, and then getting that through while we are waiting for this, which, you know, if I look at it, we've got two contestations in effect. The Kruger one is the one issue which could delay for another 3 months on average. The minute the regulations come out, we're aware from the public hearings we had in this committee when we did that, that the personal lawyers, you know, are about to hit the serious injury issue. That could take another year, because they've still got to put the thing before the court, and then there's a whole process before that. I'm very worried about the state of the Road Accident Fund as it stands at the moment, and I would appeal maybe that we look at that direction as a way forward while these other matters have been put forward, and I don't know what the implications are legally.
Thomasin, you want to say something?
No, actually, I can
say okay, yeah, good.
And
okay.
Say that to be honest with you, I don't understand the report that you're getting. Exactly what is that is being done, I don't understand.
Okay.
So, but you have heard our concerns as a community. As a bill has been passed, all that you need is regulations and all that. This court thing, there's nothing that you can do about it. But I thought, I had thought after the meeting that we had last time, you know, with all the groups and all that, I thought we would have a report. We don't have a report with us now, and I don't understand what you're saying. Maybe I was not paying attention or anything, but I don't really understand what you're saying.
No, you've understood very well, actually. You've understood very well. What the report we're getting, we are getting a report. We're getting a report which says that the consultation which had taken a long time around the, if I understand correctly, around the definition of serious injury, which involved two departments and the stakeholders, key stakeholders in the area and so on, that we've been told is now finalized. A student is correctly saying that is a whole other bundle of can of worms. Okay, and we know that it will be challenged. We've been told, and I have no reason to doubt that it will be challenged. So that's one thing. Okay, but the second thing is this procedural matter. Okay, the Marius Kruger case, which we had reports on, that went to the Pretoria Supreme Court, was found to be unprocedural. The way in which it had been implemented, brought into action, and then changed, and so on. Only we can do it. So we asked two questions. We asked the kinds of questions that you're answering now. But a second question was, would it be contempt of court if we brought it back to Parliament? So we allowed the Constitutional Court to say, as it may well, that yes, indeed, Maurice Kruger was right, and the Pretoria Supreme Court was right, that it was unprocedural and only Parliament can change it and so on. So, and we would all have to accept that, if that's the verdict, and understand and appreciate. Do we have to fiddle with our thumbs while the predictable is happening? Can we not move ahead? And that's the essence, I think, of what you're telling us.
We may move ahead. I just perhaps, but if I understand you correctly, you say, why don't we put the 160,000 cap into operation now?
Yeah.
Before
the
other
limitations. Foreign.
Well,
that is the
foreign.
Is that?
Well, it's combined.
There's no separate foreign claim. In other words, there's caps,
yes,
which then affect foreign claims. And we're keen to put it into operation.
Now, as luck would have it, that part of the amendment isn't here, but the difficulty with that is that if you look at the way Section 17 has been amended, in the amendment bill, it says repeal the entire Section 17 and replace with the following new section.
Right.
And that section is a page long. If we want to go the route that you're suggesting, and I think it's a good idea in principle, we will have to come back to Parliament and split Section 17 up into packages to say,
yeah,
all right,
yeah,
you understand that at the moment it's an undivided whole section.
Exactly.
And that process may take time. There's a risk there because, again, we will be asked, how are you going to consult about this new amendment bill that's been cut up? I don't know whether the department has told you what the outside date is for the implementation of the regulations. But it would probably be quicker to get the entire bill into operation and the regulations in place than to come back to Parliament in order to chop up bits and pieces of Section 17 and put it into place in a staggered way.
Okay. Right, on top of things?
The problem with that is that it's been a long time. We've been waiting for regulations for a very long time. So I agree with you. Much as we are waiting for the procedure of the court, but something has to be done. Because it's in a point of close that they're having serious problems. And I think that this 160 cap will work out. And you know, Chairperson, because we've been having problems with people dragging their feet on this, There are so many things that we have said in the meeting, that this is what we want as a committee, to make sure that the status of RAF is changed. So I would suggest that next time, they don't have to wait for us to call them to a meeting. We need to have a report on each and everything that we suggested as a committee. We need to have a report on what is happening with this, how far are they with anything, so that we could get a report. It's about time that we need to have a report. We need to work out something. I don't know if you're not here, but they've had the problems of RAF. There are serious problems there. And until we do something to help them, which I think starting with one, I think we have to start somewhere. I mean, waited for more than 3 years for serious injuries to be described by two departments. And I don't know what was the problem really for two departments to meet and say, what are serious injuries? It took them 3 years. So if you wait for all the regulations, you can imagine it's going to take us 10 years.
Okay, we've got the regulations now.
But we haven't passed them.
No, but you're right. Okay, now you're actually right, and we support what you're saying. I mean, obviously, we've all had a sense of, just including our colleagues from the department. And the question is that, but what do we do? Okay, I mean, how do we move the process forward as expeditiously but as smartly as possible so that we don't just end up in another? And you're saying, you're advising, and I hear what you're saying, that if we try to chop it up with a view to pushing some stuff through, we might actually find ourselves in a bigger mess because as it stands, it would be a whole new amendment bill, basically.
Yes.
And that has its own delays and consultations and so forth. Now, our problem, obviously, is we know that there will be a challenge. The current one is not the serious challenge. It's taking time, but it's not the serious. The serious challenge is around the definition of serious injury. And we know it's coming. Will that undermine the implementation of the entire bill and all of the regulations, or simply that aspect of it?
Mr. Chairman, can I just say what we've been advising the department is that, if you know, with respect to the committee, but the bill contains many, many consultation requirements.
Yes.
And some of those have not been complied with until February, March, April this year. What we were very worried and concerned about from a legal point of view is a preemptive strike. There's an interdict shortly after or even before the regulations are put into force. Because if we held up with such an interdict, because a simple consultation requirement had not been complied with, has not been complied with, then we're looking at a delay. I mean, I'm not as pessimistic as the 10 years, but we are looking at a serious potential delay of months, possibly a year. So what, as far as the substantive provisions are concerned, the definition and the assessment method, those would not be the kind of challenge that would be capable, or if you challenge this assessment method that has been chosen by the department, I don't think that will allow the opponents of the bill to get an interdict. But if we don't comply with a consultation requirement, they could easily come to court and say, now wait a bit, this says you should have consulted with medical service providers. You have not done so. Block the coming into force of the regulations and let the department first do that. See, and this is what happened this year. As far as the substance is concerned, I mean, the major challenge would be, of course, the abolition of the common law claim and the cap on serious, on general damages and the restriction of general damage to serious injury. So we're not so concerned about that. That will wind its way through the courts generally over the next few years, but that won't prevent the system from coming into force and the saving for the fund from being achieved. But Doctor, one thing that's still of some concern is the training of medical doctors on the new assessment method that has to. In the previous set of regulations, the AMA-5 was chosen as the assessment method. That has been replaced now by the AMA-6. Perhaps sufficient training has not been done on the AMA-6 of doctors, but that can still take place. It's not in many months.
James, maybe just on that particular point, that is also a concern to the department, and we actually engaged with the RAF in the presence of requesting them directly whether or not they will be able to operationally, effectively and efficiently deal with the implementation of AMA96, which we've consulted and everyone agreed with. And they actually in writing confirmed that on 1 July 2008, they will be in a position to operationally implement AMA96. That is the dealing with the general plan.
Okay, well, I'm anxious not to chew up too much time of the just telling here, but yeah.
Which, you know, maybe Advocate Duval missed when I did speak about the legitimacy of the current operations vis-a-vis the board and all that and the governance of the organization and all the risks associated with that. Could you just comment on, you know, what is the status quo?
You'll have to explain that somewhat more.
I'm also not following, to be honest.
The appointment of the board, as I understand it, in terms of the amendment, was going to be subjected to certain clauses in that act, if I recall, in terms of the appointment. Now, are we saying that the existing board that was appointed previously is in fact the responsible and accountable body in terms of the governance of the present scheme, or is the board that's now been currently imposed in accordance with those rules the one that's in place? Maybe, Doctor, you should, I don't know, you've got my gist, you shot in my head, but I think it's an issue which we need to understand, because someone's got to be held accountable. At this stage, as I know, in terms of our role as parliamentarian, I mean, we cannot, do oversight in that respect.
There's an extremely important question also one raised by us. That is actually the reason why the RAF joined the Constitutional Court proceeding and requested the Constitutional Court to make a finding on that specific matter. Procedurally wise, however, we went through this particular process problem through the RTP, I think, about a year ago. We did not appoint a legitimate board, CBRTA. And so we had to retract a little bit and just legalize the appointment of the RAF board. We will go through a similar procedural process to get the approval, even retrospectively, from the minister, whether or not there's an affirmative or negative verdict by the Knowledge Kruger bench. So in my opinion, that was my internal legal advice obtained, is that it will not really affect the legitimacy of the existing board and the resolutions taken by the existing board. However, when we go to the minister firstly for approval, it will imply that the correct version of the amended act will be promulgated, and similarly we will have a confirmation in writing from the minister confirming the appointment of the board members. So it's more a procedural matter than actually a legal matter, but I think we will be able to confirm that.
Okay, so thanks for opening another can of worms. Okay. No, but it is important, and you're, I appreciate it. Okay. Basically, obviously, thanks, Professor Duval, for coming along. That's appreciated. The call is in your hands, not ours, as a department, but we appreciate you coming to brief us about the, because we're obviously watching this whole matter with anxiety and a sense of frustration that the legislation we spend a lot of time on and under a lot of pressure also to move more quickly than we were perhaps, it's still in limbo. But so thank you all of you for that input. We'd be interested to see the opinion.
Can I suggest just make a one page summary of it?
Maybe just to wrap up on the department side, in other words, what we would like to inform the portfolio committee on is that we are going to request the minister to approve the regulations and the Amendment Act for implementation of 1 July.
Okay.
So the paperwork will be done, whether the minister will actually approve that will be his expression,
right.
But we will participate in the process and try to finalize that.
Okay, well, good luck, and thanks for that. Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay. Okay, so let's then move on to the Civil Aviation Authority. We've got Duke Marusi, who's the well-known to us. Welcome back, Duke, who's the chairman of the board. He'll introduce his delegation and take us through.
Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee. Allow me to introduce to my right Captain Colin Representative and Commissioner of the Aviation. And next to me is Philo Tata, the Executive Manager in the CEO's office, with special emphasis on strategy. As a way of introduction for Captain Jadon, you will recall, Chair, that last year when we presented our strategy, we did indicate that we were expecting two audits from the ICAO and the FAA, and we did some of the highlights were potential risks with regard to skills and some of the legislation, especially the authority around the CEO and commissioner. The audits are subject to change, and if they confirm those, and in addressing the findings, the minister set up a task team, and also took an imperative directive to combine the two provisions into one. As a stopgap whilst the harmonization of the laws are taking place. The then CEO, Mr. Mears, opted to step down. And I must emphasize, it had nothing to do with Nationwide. It was just timing issue. But it had nothing to do with Nationwide. And Captain Jadon then was appointed the new CEO slash commissioner. Captain Jadon comes from SAA. He's got over 50 years of aviation experience, both as an airline captain and management. His last position at SAA, he was the general manager in charge of operations, where he had a staff of over 800 pilots, over 2,000 cabin attendants, and 200 administrative people. So we were very grateful and lucky to have received him at the CAA to carry on the mandate that we have already set for us. And on that note, I'd like to hand over to you.
Thank you, Duke, and welcome. And,
thank you. By the way, there could be questions on, but then I think this presentation will address some of those questions.
Related to the matters you were talking about, the ICAO audit and stuff. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair. Good morning to the members of the committee. I would just like to emphasize that the report that was circulated was a draft report, and we have done updates that is being circulated electronically, and the copies that have been produced. This is the updated report. In updated with regard to the latest progress that's taken place since the report was originally compiled, and also some issues taken out which were not really relevant to our strategic direction. So the purpose of the presentation is to give the committee an overview of the strategic direction of the Civil Aviation Authority. Our vision and mission have not changed in the last couple of years, and our vision still remains the excellence in aviation safety and security. That is our mandate. We are in business to regulate both aviation safety and security throughout the entire civil aviation industry. We seek to do it in an efficient, cost-effective, sustainable, and customer-friendly manner. However, I would like to emphasize that we do talk about our customers as being the airlines and maintenance organizations and the pilots and the crew that we license. However, our real customer is the public, the traveling public, and we are very mindful of the fact that our duty is to regulate the operators to ensure that we have safe air transport in the country. four major issues were highlighted in the portfolio committee meeting last year. That was the lack of skilled capacity, which would lead to negative ICAO and FAA findings, a high level of vacancies, which in fact has led to a dysfunctional institution, the role of the CEO and the commissioner as stipulated in the legislation, and more disclosure on equity performance, and we'll seek to address all four of these items in the presentation. Actions taken since the last meeting. As our chairman has said, that I was appointed as a technically and administratively qualified CEO to carry the position of both CEO and commission in December 2007. Three operational experts from ICAO were contracted, subcontracted for a short period of time, 1 year contracts each, to assist with skills transfer, and two additional experts have been budgeted for in other technical departments, particularly with the airworthiness. The three that we have are all in flight operations. In the last 6 to 8 months, the number of inspectors within the organization has more approximately doubled. By the 1st of January, we had appointed all of our new airworthiness inspectors. Just to bring the committee up to speed, airworthiness inspectors are the ones that inspect the maintenance facilities and the maintenance organizations. They inspect the aircraft or airworthiness, as opposed to our flight operations inspectors that go and look at the operators and carry out audits on nationwide South African Airways, Mango, and all of the major operators. In fact, all of the operators in the country, but obviously the emphasis on the major operators. So we recruited all of our airworthiness inspectors. They have now been fully trained. Training takes a minimum of 4 months to bring them up to operational speed, and after that is on the job training that takes place. Our flight operations inspectorate is now 85% staffed. The delay in getting the additional inspectors relates to the specific qualifications we need in that regard. It is a requirement of ICAO that we have an inspector, a minimum of one inspector qualified for every single large aircraft type flying in the country. By large aircraft, we're talking about those with approximately more than 9 seats. And there are a lot of those flying in this country. And in fact, on the South African register, flying out of the country as well. And so to try and find one that has those particular qualifications, that is still current, and that can be trained as an inspector, is quite a task. However, we are confident that within the next 2 to 3 months, we will have completed that exercise.
You know, you carefully explained to us the difference between airworthy inspectors and flight operation inspectors.
Correct.
And I didn't quite get it, okay. So the first is really about the maintenance side of...
Correct. A typical airworthiness inspector will be a qualified aircraft technician.
Right.
So we have got people from SAA Technical, from SAFA, and all of the major organizations, the small organizations obviously as well, having the necessary qualifications to carry out oversight on the specific organizations that we're auditing. Flight operations inspectors are all pilots. All ex-pilots, retired pilots, pilots that have
The ones that so it's the operational methods, whether they are...
They go to audit the flight operations section, the operations section, ground operations, that portion of it.
Okay.
They'll check the licensing and the training of the crew.
I've got it. Got it. Okay. Thank you.
The role of the CA Commissioner was combined by a ministerial director at the end of last year, and we have now completed the draft bill, I should say we, the Department of Transport, together with our legal team and our experts as well, have consolidated three of the aviation acts, the South African Aviation Act, the South African Civil Aviation Act, and the Aviation Offences Act. That has been combined into one new act called the Aviation Act of 2008, and that is now for public comment at the moment. And in the new act, it clearly states the combined position, which will be now known as the Director of Aviation. And then the high level of vacancies, we've recruited and appointed 55 specialists since the beginning of the year, and that follows on quite a bit of recruitment that happened in the last 3 months of 2007. on our equity performance, gender and race, we believe that we have a pretty good balance. A bit down on the female side, which is something that we haven't very mindful of, particularly within our senior management side of things, and we are addressing it. But we believe that our gender composition and our racial composition is well within the norms required in terms of employment.
Yeah, let's do that for the more substantive issues, yeah. Clarificatory, like my confusion is too. I think that's okay, but yeah. More substantive issues, let's wait for the confusion. If that's okay with you.
That's fine.
Yeah, yeah.
On the next slide, we have our employee profile. As can be expected because of the nature of the industry, we see that white males do predominate in the role of professionals. Typically, your experienced pilots and the ones that we are able to get are retired airline pilots and retired technicians who traditionally have been white males. And therefore, at this point in time, we do have a number of them. However, the training program in place to recruit from within the industry is working very well, and we have been able to attract, particularly within our management ranks, some very highly qualified young professionals from the other race groups as well. We are confident that that will continue in that way. Coloured male, coloured female, Indian male, Indian female. On the disabled side, we are very aware of our relative shortage and have made an effort to recruit wherever we can. And in fact, have set up a compact with an agency which specializes in providing employees for disabled employees for organizations such as ourselves, and we are working with the Department of Transport in harmonizing that as well. Our demographics versus the Gauteng are, we believe, as good as we can get at this point in time. Obviously, the balance is something that, that does shift from time to time. But the important thing that I've found coming to the CA and going forward is that it is truly an organization that is functioning as we believe our nation should be functioning. And that is without boundaries of race or color or gender. And we believe that it is something that can be held up to show that all of us can participate to produce a very functional organization. Right, moving on to the ICAO audit that happened in the middle of last year, and that will be followed by a short presentation on the FAA audit. ICAO is the International Civil Aviation Organization, which is responsible for all international aviation. Traditionally, ICAO have audited countries and their civil aviation authorities and kept the results very quiet. From the 1st of April, that, however, has changed. And from now on, all countries' audit findings will be posted on the ICAO website. In fact, it has been done already. Of the states that have been audited in the last 12 to 24 months, I'm not sure exactly what the time period, if we look at the graph, a small bar is good. A large bar indicates a large number of non-compliances to ICAO standards and recommended practices. So if we compare ourselves to the average of the international findings, at the time of the audit in July 2007, the red bar shows where we were, and the green bar shows where we were at the end of March 2008. Although it may appear high in certain areas that we still have a number of findings, once the new legislation is passed and promulgated, and the regulations that go with that, many of those, in fact, will drop down to zero. I'll give you an example of that. On the very far right hand side is resolution of safety issues, which we show no movement in that regard, but that specifically relates to the total separation of our accident investigation unit from the CAA. Although they are independent at the moment and they are funded and reported to the Department of Transport, they are still quite, from a functional and a structural point of view, they are part of the CA. The minute that the new bill comes into law, that in fact will be dropped to zero.
Yes. You talk too much, but I heard nothing. Can I just get is that a simple position? Are we performing well in terms of our car?
We're performing very well in terms of
our car. Thank you very much.
The next slide, unfortunately, is a very small one, but it is just a copy of the letter that we received on January 4th, 2008 from the Federal Aviation Administration through the Embassy of the United States, stating that the audit that was conducted in July-August 2007 and followed up with follow-up inspection on the 19th of December 2007 resulted in South Africa retaining its Category 1 status. To inform the members of the committee, besides the audits that ICAO does, the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, conduct audits on all countries that have operators that fly into the United States. One of the main reasons for this is a litigation issue. They were taken to court a number of years back when an operator crashed in the United States with a lot of fatalities on board, and the FAA, in fact, was taken to court and sued for not having oversight. And they have this program.
And this was a foreign operator.
It was a foreign operator.
Yeah.
So they have this program, and what they do is they come and they audit countries.
Yeah.
There are only five countries in the whole of Africa that, in fact, have got Category 1 status. And South Africa being one of them. It was a major, major milestone. During the initial audit in July, August, there were a number of findings. The CAA was given, and the Department of Transport was given 45 days in which to rectify those findings. It was a huge task. I came in at the end of that process, so I'd like to take some credit for it, but I can't take very much credit for it. But it was a huge task. We were told after the event that the FAA on the 19th of December, in fact, had arrived with a draft letter recommending that we would be downgraded to Category 2 status. But based on the presentations that we made to them during that day and their further investigations during that day at 6 o'clock in the evening, the lead auditor spoke to me privately and said their recommendation would be that in fact to retain Category 1 status. We are cognizant of the fact that we were found to be compliant. The FAA indicated that as the leading aviation nation in Africa, they would like to see us a lot more than compliant. They were very happy with the momentum that had taken place in the last few months of 2007, and they are coming back in June of this year to see whether that momentum in fact has continued. I'm very happy to report that it has continued. The training that we said we'd be doing, that we would be doing, has taken place. The audits that we said we would be doing have taken place, and we believe that when the FAA do come back in June, they will be very pleasantly surprised with the progress that we have made today. The summary findings, the fact that we were found compliant in all issues, didn't mean that we were still lacking in certain areas. There are a couple of them that are still outstanding. The majority of them are very close to being completed. For example, surveillance of the congregations, the second last line there. On the 13th of May, we will have finished our final audit at one time, and then it will be 100% complete. And the very last line should have been changed to 100%.
Yeah.
Resolution of safety concerns. Chair, if you would like, to take questions before I move into the next section, I'm very happy to do that, or I'll continue.
Let's continue, I think.
Right.
Let's continue.
We have been experiencing challenges in three major areas. The first of that is international regulatory compliance. The second is the challenge of industry oversight. And the third is in terms of our civil aviation regulations. And we put a number of interventions in place to counter those. I'll just deal with the international regulatory compliance. Obviously, first of all, it's a requirement that we speedily resolve all of the FAA and ICAO audit findings. We went through an accelerated implementation plan of the corrective action plans of both FAA and ICAO, and the majority of those are complete now. Implementation of technical guidance material for the whole industry, that is pretty far advanced, and we're working very closely with our ICAO experts in bringing that material in line with international best practice. Implementation of safety management systems within the industry, we have addressed, and the separation of the air safety investigation unit from the CAA is also being addressed. Activations, interventions on the next slide, they are self-explanatory. I would just like to say that we've taken the findings of both ICAO and the FAA, and I have created a continuous business improvement committee within the CAA that sits every 2 weeks, in which certain deliverables are required to be met. And this is an ongoing process, and it will continue even after the final FAA report in June of this year. Technical guidance material and safety management system are being addressed in industry training and workshops. A number have been held already, and we will continue with it throughout the next 12 months. And the independence of the SAP Investigations Unit is addressed in the new Draft Aviation Act 2008. Challenges with regard to oversight with the roles of the Commission and the CEO and the result of that particular one. I'd like to dwell a bit on what we term NTC, a non-type certified aircraft. Traditionally, all aircraft that were flying in the world were manufactured by either the large manufacturers like Boeing and Airbus and McDonnell Douglas, to have a little and the smaller aircraft like companies like Beechcraft, Cessna, and Piper. In the last 10 to 20 years, however, with the advance of composite materials in particular, we find a proliferation of new types of aircraft that have developed from home-built, what traditionally was known as the home-built industry, where people would get a set of plans and build the aircraft in their garage. Now we are finding that there are small companies that are producing a large number of aircraft, and these aren't type certified according to the normal standards that are applied to the aircraft that we traditionally have been flying. Now, the reason I want to dwell on this is that when we look at the accident statistics in South Africa, our accident record, particularly in commercial aviation, is actually quite amazing. Because one of the things that we believe convinced the FAA to turn around their position on South Africa. Just one statistic. The first jet airliner, commercial jet airliner flight that was ever undertaken was done from London to Johannesburg. British Overseas Airways Corporation, BOAC as they were known, Comet flew from London to Johannesburg in May 1952. Since that date, and I'm touching lots of wood, there hasn't been one single fatality on a commercial airliner on South African soil as a result of an accident. Now, that excludes Helderberg and the other ones that happen outside the country. And I think it's important to recognize that this isn't just a function of the regulatory role that the CAA has had over the years and still currently has, but it's a function of the whole aviation industry, from the airports, air traffic and navigation services, everything that goes with. And this is a very proud record that we have. It's something that we are trying to emphasize and get out of the marketplace as well. Having said that, we believe that, you know, an accident can happen at any time. And obviously our job is to ensure that the chances of this happening are absolutely minimized as much as possible. Having said that about our airline industry, obviously, in the light aviation, in the light aircraft sector, the record is not that good. Although having said that, we had a total of 48 fatalities, with something like 10,000 aircraft actively flying at any one time in the country. Total of 48 fatalities last year. If you compare that to a day Johannesburg alone on the roads, then I think it sort of puts it in perspective. Having said that, obviously we are still looking very closely at why these accidents are occurring. One thing that I noticed coming into the CAA is that there hasn't really been, been a change in mindset of the safety approach of the regulator and the industry, in fact, from what it was when I started flying in the early 70s as a student at Wits University. And what we have undertaken to do is to come up with a strategy for light aircraft in particular, which is going to have a major impact, we hope will have a major impact, not only on the statistics, but on the safety in general of general aviation. And so the sort of thing we've been looking at there that has been very effective in the airline industry in reducing the rate of accidents is, for example, training pilots in particular in what is known as crew resource management. That works in a multi-crew environment, and it's very, very effective, whereas the majority of these type of accidents happen in a single-crew environment. And a lot of work has been done throughout the world. We are looking at the research that has been done, and we're looking at introducing it into training service, into the training service for private pilots in particular, and for the pilots that fly these very light aircraft. The third challenge has been adequate oversight of the number of operators that are flying South African registered aircraft in foreign countries, particularly in Africa and the Middle East. We now believe that we do have sufficient inspectors available to go out and conduct the surveillance that is necessary in all parts of the world. Another issue that has been a major concern to us is oversight of foreign operators coming into the country. We've stepped up this activity significantly since the end of last year. In particular, and I'd just like to mention it, we had our inspectors go out to inspect ad hoc, on an ad hoc basis, any operator coming into South Africa. And this we're entitled to do, and it's the right of any authority within the country to do that. In particular, we saw one company coming in from the DRC. I'll mention their name, Hugh Agora. And in fact, we grounded all of the aircraft initially. By grounding the aircraft, it meant that they were required to remove that aircraft from the country with no passengers on board. We had reactions from the lawyers. We were convinced that we were right in doing that. Told Hugh Agora that they're welcome to send aircraft that they believe are airworthy and inspect them when they arrive. And I think out of their total fleet, we've only allowed two aircraft to continue operating into South Africa. One of the aircraft that we condemned, in fact, was involved in the fatal accident in the DRC not too long ago with the loss of over 40 lives. So we believe that this is effective, and we're doing the right thing, and we will continue in that regard. Our enforcement action is something that we are working very closely on, in particular the one expert that we have from ICAO that is coming to us from the FAA through ICAO is very strong in enforcement, and he has been conducting enforcement training for the majority of our inspectors. And the final issue that we're looking at, this is more in terms of security, as required in terms of our national aviation security plan, is a compulsory registration of all airstrips in the country. This isn't meant as a big brother issue, but we're doing it particularly in all the very small farm strips and the ones that a lot of these microlights fly out of. We're doing it to enable the owners of these airstrips just to give us an update on an annual basis of exactly what the status of that particular airstrip is. And who's flying into what typical traffic takes place, so that we do have something to go into our database. And it's being well received by industry. I'm going to look at some of the accident statistics part of our reporting of accident statistics is not really adequate, because when we look at the accidents, as I mentioned before, they typically relate to the general aviation sector, and the numbers that you see at the bottom are the movements that we get from AXA, from Air Traffic and Navigation Services, which are only aircraft that fire flight plans. Most tend to be the larger aircraft, the commuter aircraft, the charter aircraft, and obviously all the airlines. And so we're putting in place a plan now which will require all aircraft owners to register with us on our website, and on a monthly basis they will be sent a reminder by email to file with us the number of hours and the number of takeoffs and landings that they have done. Hopefully the takeoffs equal the number of landings, but once we have those statistics in place, we will then be able to comply with our ICAO's requirement where we report the number of accidents per 100,000 flights, which is the international norm. So at this point in time, we're purely looking at the numbers of accidents, and it doesn't really show the trend that we would like to show, which is that there's an increase in flying, there's an increase in accidents, and therefore it's purely related to the activity. Or if we're flying and the number of accidents remains static, we're doing something right. So we need to get those stats right, and it's a very large project that we have in place. I've just indicated in red where the activity in Gauteng and the Western Cape in particular has increased in the last 3 months between 2006 and 2007. Right, interventions. The only one I really want to discuss there is the memorandum of understanding that we are looking to enter into with other countries. It's something that is an international problem. Really what it will allow us to do, and this Article 83 bis is an article to the Chicago Convention on International Air Transport. It will allow, for example, South Africa and Kenya to sign a bilateral agreement whereby if a South African operator conducts operations in Kenya, we then give the Kenyan authority the right to conduct inspections on our behalf, and vice versa, we can do it on their behalf. It is an ongoing thing, and there are a lot of legal challenges involved in that, but once this is in place, it becomes a practice that will certainly make our life and the life of all of the regulatory authorities throughout the world a lot easier. I mentioned GNSS just because it is a major development that is taking place within the world and within South Africa. This is the introduction of global navigation satellite systems, known to many of you as GPS. You have it in motor cars, you have it in cell phones these days. It uses the American satellite system, there's also a European and a Russian system. And aviation has had it for a long time, but they haven't been able to use it to conduct approaches in bad weather. There's a huge amount of work that has been done internationally. The regulations have been promulgated now, and we are allowing, on a step-by-step basis, our airlines, starting with the airlines first, to conduct these approaches. What it means in practice is that we can fly an aircraft into an airfield that doesn't have any navigation aids on the ground at all, purely using space-based systems and onboard-based systems. The enhancement in safety is significant because a large number of accidents that do take place even in the airline sector is based or happens when you have controlled flight into terrain, which means that the aircraft is working perfectly well. The pilot's just not quite sure where they are when they fly into terrain. And using these type of systems, we believe particularly in Africa where there are always power problems, there are problems in maintenance of navigational aids, this is a great improvement in safety in general. And we're introducing it now in South Africa, and we hope with the new year to impact it available for the light aircraft industry as well. It's a phasing approach using the carriers that have quite experience of using other countries first and then rolling it out to the rest of the industry. Our enforcement action against non-compliant industry players. We basically have suspension. We introduced the system of penalties because up until now we really haven't had much of a bite. The worst thing that we could do is we could suspend the pilot's license for a period of time or a maintenance organization, so approval for a period of time, and then they would begin operation as normal. We now have regulations which will allow us in the very short future to in fact introduce penalties for non-compliance. And some of them are in fact quite simple. We believe that this is going to assist us in getting what we hope will be voluntary compliance as opposed to having to force compliance of the operators and maintenance organizations. And also we have been actually laying a number of criminal charges against the particular individuals who have regularly and repeatedly contravened regulations and acts.
Captain Jordan, I'm personally enjoying this and finding it very fascinating. I wonder if I could ask you to just, in the interests of getting, a little bit. Thank you. Thank you.
I want to run through the rest of the green challenges on regulations.
I mean, please don't skip over things that you think are important.
No, they are there, and I think they are pretty self-explanatory as well.
Yeah.
The regulations, obviously, the major issue has been the harmonization of our primary legislation, which is the New Aviation Act. That bill is out for comment at the moment. Our regulations are dealt with in the CARCOM, the Civil Aviation Regulations Committee. We are busy revamping that whole organization with that whole structure to improve the promulgation of regulations and to speed them up. One of the things that I'll be doing is the commission is taking over the chairmanship of that particular committee and also we'll be holding meetings on a more regular basis. We'll also have a process in place with the Department of Transport where we call these to go through a very lengthy process and the DOT will agree that they will reduce the time that it takes to pass the regulations through and have them signed by the Minister. Big new part are security regulations, which is part 108, and the regulations have been passed, the technical standards on the process have been passed, and they'll come into effect in the next month or two. We've identified all of our outstanding regulations and technical standards, and we've streamlined them, and we are conducting workshops to assist with the implementation of part 108, and a very big part has been creation of the Aviation Security Managers Forum. As the committee knows, security worldwide has become a major issue. Certainly from a compliance point of view, both ICAO and the FAA will conduct regular audits in this regard, and I must say congratulations to ACES in particular. The recent audit conducted down in Cape Town by the TSA, that's the US Transportation Security Agency, resulted in absolutely no findings. Our objectives is to oversee the functioning and development of the civil aviation industry, to control, regulate, and promote security and safety, and to look at the 8 ICAO critical elements, those are the ones that we showed in the graph, and just ensure that we are compliant with international requirements. One of our stated goals is to reduce as far as possible, it's not always 100% possible, but to reduce as far as possible our notification to ICAO of non, what's the right word for the all states notify ICAO that they are not going to comply with a specific regulation or a recommended practice. Pilots, that's exactly what I was looking for. Thank you. So our intention is to reduce the number of differences that are filed. As it is, we're on one page in the manual, which is actually pretty low right now, but our intention is to reduce it to as close to zero as we can get. We have a DOT performance agreement. We will be completing two new ones, so it's a new board that will hopefully be announced within the next few days. And the DOT will contract a performance agreement with myself as well in my role in charge of safety and security oversight. Our board strategy is still in place, and we have five strategic themes, which are shown in the little blue dots there, similar to compliance, industry functioning and growth, effective systems and processes, growing customer satisfaction, which as I said includes the traveling public and development of human capital. I've listed some key performance areas and key performance indicators. Again, they are relatively self-explanatory. I'd just like to deal on the last part, which is to ensure financial viability with current tariffs. We had a tariff increase from 6 rand per passenger to 10 rand per passenger from the 1st of January to help offset the large additional number of staff that we had to employ, particularly in highly qualified technicians. These days don't come cheap. We believe, however, that we'll be able to sustain the organization with that going forward. Looking at our financials, we've just given a snapshot indication. Our financial year closed at the end of March 2008, showing, in fact, a net operating deficit of 4 million rand. The budgeted deficit was 48 million rand. The difference being due to a grant that we received from the Treasury through the Department of Transport of 21 million rand, and the other areas is the depletion of reserves that we had in place, of some of the reserves, not entirely, and a lot of fiscal prudence that was introduced into the organization as well. In the 3 years going forward, we're still foreseeing a deficit for 2008-2009 and showing a net income based on projected revenue increasing at the current rate of growth of aviation, which has been 11%. So it is a relatively bullish outlook, but we believe it is realistic. Expenses, as you can see, we are expecting to increase quite considerably, the majority of that being due to the additional staff costs and the additional oversight costs, which does include quite a bit of travel to countries within the Middle East and Africa where we have operators operating. We have undertaken to the DOT that we will commence with a zero-based budgeting process in June, just after the FAA have come out for their visit. And I think this will be the first time in a number of years that this exercise has been concluded. But it is necessary because of the huge number of additional staff that we've taken on board. We need to get a clear handle on exactly what our costs are going forward. So once that has been done, we will review that against the tariffs and the safety charges that have been put in place, and hopefully we can review those as well. I've discussed the revenue, staff costs. I'd just like to emphasize that there is a global shortage of pilots and technical skills. We've seen a huge outflow of pilots and technicians in particular in the last 12 months. SAA has lost unprecedented numbers of pilots. I think it's been mentioned in the press, about 300 technicians have left. Either left the country or left the industry. That is also a very worrying issue for the industry because there are other sections of industry, such as the boat building industry, even motor cars, which are poaching aviation qualified technicians, particularly in the composites arena, composites and aluminium working, which are now being employed in other forms of transportation. It's a very worrying concern to the whole industry, and we are participating with SAA and the Air Force at the moment the setting up of the African Aviation Training Initiative, AATI, in which we're looking at utilizing the facilities at Lanabar BAT to provide a training school for both pilots and technicians. And the program is actually pretty far advanced, and we believe that it should start its first training program early next year. And the CA will be participating in that. Future development. We are undertaking feasibility studies at the moment to procure a site that we hope to develop just after 2010, when our current lease expires. At the moment, we're leasing two buildings in mid-rand for about 13.5 million per year, and our maintenance costs account for a further 3.4 million. The CA is not going to go away, it's going to be around for many, many years to come. And we believe we need to develop an infrastructure and a building in particular that will meet our specific needs. We have been working with the DOT in certain areas, for example, this is just one example, there is no aviation library in the country. It doesn't exist. There is a huge amount of material that is currently sitting in private collections. We've been informed by a number of academics, and as the individuals that have done the collecting have died, so they are bequeathing these very, very valuable collections to all sorts of institutions, but nothing is coming into a central repository. So with the DOT's library, we would, for example, be looking at expanding our current technical library to include a section for the public and for academics to come in and have a full library of technical publications and aviation publications going forward. That's just one example. We don't have very much space for training of people. We need to have proper training facilities. We're using ATMS. Our staff have to ride right across to the other side of the airport to have training done there. So there are a lot of things that we can do. The flow of information within our building is diabolical, in fact. And with having two separate buildings, we have documentation that goes from one building to the next and back sometimes two or three, four times. In the process of dealing with the documentation gets lost and there are major security concerns. So we believe that using some of the reserves that we have in place at the moment, we can do a very cost-effective exercise, and that if we can start construction after 2010, when we believe that a number of construction companies will be looking for work, having completed the obligations in terms of the Soccer World Cup, we can actually pick up quite a good deal. So that's where we go forward. And we're also looking ideally to be close to an airport and Grand Central, which is the place to be and is very close to the ground at the moment. And a very good contract station. That's my
wonderful. Thank you very much. Okay. Thanks for that. Thanks for the comprehensive input. Okay, let's open it up. Bear in mind that we must also be a bit economical with our time because we've got a full AXA report as well. Okay. I recognize Achille, Ntava Singh, and Stuart.
Yes,
Chairperson,
I've got an issue here. There's an airliner called Italian Airlines, and it's operating a 6-seater from Nelspruit to Barney Bay. And one day, I was supposed to take that 6-seater from Joseph to Nelspruit around 7 o'clock in the night, and it could not take off because the driver, always called the pilot, claimed that it doesn't have, I think it's a radar or something to assist it to fly in what weapon. Now the question is whether that thing is the airworthy, and how do we really ensure that this kind of thing won't happen? Because that aircraft flew from the state to do that. But then when it had to go back, and then it was in the night, and then it had these other problems that now you can plan. But I think the pilot was a positive chance, I think it was taking a chance to fly us down there. So that is the one thing that I have.
Okay. And you support the idea that he should have taken the chance?
Well, what I'm saying is, if the pilot was a chancer,
he would have done it.
You would have done it.
Okay. Okay, that's your question.
The question is that you have got this kind of aircraft,
yeah,
within the system, and whether there is any way that we can assist to reduce those kind of chances happening.
Okay.
The other thing is, I tend to be interested in those things that you can't comply with in a car. You talked about the one region. And I would like to be informed or maybe receive that one region and explanations why those particular things that you can't comply, that you have indicated to them and which one is the reason. And if I can be informed on that one, so that
thanks, man. Let's hold, and if you don't mind taking a package of things, okay? Tapas,
thanks, Chairperson. One of the questions I was going to ask is that relationship with ATMS, and I think they said the training of these ATMS for training already.
That's more building, a facility issue. Yeah, okay. He was making an argument for a new building, which we support. Which we support.
How about the shortage and the stuff that you are using? Do you have the staff retention and the company? Or what is it that you are doing to make sure that the staff that you have the other thing is, I was just wondering, when you did your presentation, when you talked about growing customer satisfaction, I mean, how do you do that? How do you monitor that? Because I thought that you're only with the agency. Chairperson, you said you randomly inspect. Just choose where we are going to inspect every expert and audit. Because I'm just thinking, is there a situation when, at times maybe you pick on the same aircraft and audit, you don't do others. Would the situation be there that at one stage you'll be able to inspect all the aircraft? Is it possible? And the other thing is, when you talk at a aircraft from the FAA finding, is there any reason why others are not completed? If it has not completed, like others are 80%, 60%, is there any reason for that? Thank you.
Okay, if you don't mind, we're overloading a little bit, but Stuart? Stuart's going to ask just two issues.
Yeah, Chair, I don't have many, other than to say, first of all, I'd like to compliment Captain Budan and his team, particularly in the manner in which they handle some of the very scary aspects of the engines falling off, etc. I think it was well handled, and you know,
by the pilot's concerns as well, actually.
No, certainly, and I think that, you know, just to recap on some, you know, reports that I had, and I want to thank again CAA for the way they acted on it, because I was told about that DRC aircraft, and having phoned up within 10-15 minutes, I'd had a response from your CEO and your aviation inspectors where they grounded that aircraft, which was flying around without engines, etc. But needless to say, to come to the point of the aspect of, you know, flight technicians and engineers and whether we have adequate staffing of that particular type of category of people, we travel quite frequently as MPs, I'm afraid to say. And what we are noticing is that more and more aircraft are being grounded and delayed because of technical issues. And I'm talking specifically about SAA here. And I just want to get some assurance from you that, you know, there isn't any special treatment that are given there as opposed to some of the smaller aircraft operations which are easier to handle. And, you know, what is the status of those aircraft with all those glitches, as I call them, which seem to delay us more and more and become more and more concerning and worrying to us? and you know how the whole aspect of the flight of technicians and engineers out of the country is going to impact on that. The other one, you know, relates to the major issue which I think is facing you, and that's the CEO versus the commissioner's roles. Now, we haven't seen the new legislation that's coming to the fore, which, you know, combines certain aviation acts together.
Just on that, presumably it's on the internet, on the site, mm-hmm. on the website. Yeah,
it's
for public.
Okay. I haven't picked up on it yet. Okay. I mean, I don't want to preempt that, but I would just like to understand, you know, more of that, because, you know, we have always been, or certainly myself, have been of opinion that there should be a separation of those roles, clearly, you know, particularly in light of the operational side on the one hand and the actual regulatory body on the other. So I want to get from you, you know, what your understanding of that is, and, you know, I know a lot of international companies or international states are actually doing that, but maybe if you can just try and give me some clarity. And finally, you know, in view of the new board appointments, and this is not something particularly for you, but also for the department, we recently went through a process of revising the Transport Agency General Laws Amendment, where we appealed in terms of all those sections that there should be some sort of notice of appointment taking place. Now, I was absolutely shocked when I went to my computer and pulled off the cabinet memorandum or minutes of the 30th of April and see that there's a whole range of new board members that have been appointed to CAA. And I'm just sort of, you know, wondering whether in fact they have been compliant with regulations there, in the department in particular, in forwarding those names, because they should have come to this parliament, this portfolio committee in particular, prior to any course for publication in the Gazette. Now, that has not happened, and here I'm surprised to see, and I'm not aware, and I don't even think the present CEO is aware of these appointments. Yeah. I can tell you they are, if you want to know, but I mean, at the end of the day, they were approved on the 30th of April.
Have you got the Transport General Laws Amendments Act in front of you? Just remind us what it says.
It says here that notice of appointment, the minister shall within 30 days from the date of appointment of a member or alternate member of the board inform parliament and cause a notice to be published in the government gazette.
Okay, that's after appointment. It's not before appointment. That's what I was, the way you were raising the matter.
It's from the date of appointment.
Yeah, but it's after appointment.
So I assume we will then go through that process in order to...
No,
you
know, what we need to be is informed. Within 30 days of their appointment. Okay,
and the
appointments took place? 30th of April. Okay, so you've got 20 days to inform us. Okay, we'll start something of that order.
All right.
Okay. So you can get away with not informing us. But in the spirit of...
But I think even in the original Act, if I'm not mistaken, certainly we were trying to get some generic things through all of them.
Yeah.
But I think you need to go back and look at that, because in the other Act, it's even worse, because it actually comes back to this portfolio committee prior to that.
Yeah.
So I think I'm just putting a cautionary note out here, one needs to look at this and take heed of it, whether it was prior or before the proclamation of this.
Okay, just on that one, and then we'll get on to the other. Let's not make a meal of it, but let's just say that whether the Act is yet enacted, promulgated or not, obviously the spirit of what we were doing there was we were relinquishing some of our involvement in the appointment and so on, which we willingly did. But we said, as it were, the trade-off was that it would be important that we were informed. And so even if it's we're asking you politely in the next... couple of weeks, if you could formally inform Parliament, even if there's not a promulgation. Thanks for that. Okay, so we won't dwell on that matter. Okay, let's over to our colleagues from CAA.
Questions in order that they were asked. So in connection with the Interlink particular slide, Interlink operate as a non-scheduled airline.
No,
it's a scheduled airline. But the size of aircraft that they have that they operate on their license could probably vary. So they're probably restricted to a maximum of 30 seats or something to that effect. On the day they decide to operate a particular aircraft, I'm only going to guess now, obviously I don't know what the circumstances are. Flying in the daytime, where you can see the clouds, in particular the thunder clouds, in a small aircraft, you can fly low and you can avoid thunderstorms. Flying at night time, unfortunately, you can't see the thunder clouds. So it would be irresponsible for a pilot to decide you'll fly from Nelspruit to Joburg in the daytime, but going back at night time, particularly if there's cloud in the Nelspruit area and is now flying under instrument flight conditions, with embedded thunderstorms in that cloud, it becomes extremely dangerous. And therefore, the decision not to fly because the radar was not working. I don't know what that particular aircraft was. If it was a twin-engine airplane, I imagine that it would have had a radar. The radar maybe just wasn't functioning. It might have been functioning coming up from Nelspruit when you got to Joburg. It stopped functioning. This does happen.
They know that it's not functioning.
Sorry?
They know that it's not functioning.
As I say, you know, that is a call for the particular company. Obviously, from the regulatory point of view, is we check to see whether the aircraft is operational. And now, radar is not a mandatory requirement for an IFR flight in instrument flight conditions. It's not a requirement to do instrument flying without a radar on board the airplane. It would just be very stupid to do that if you know that there are thunderstorms in the area, because that's what the radar picks up, is thunderstorms. So that's not a requirement, it's from a regulatory point of view. The differences page I referred to is not non-compliance. All countries, in fact virtually all countries, file differences with ICAO for specific reasons. It may be that their particular infrastructure or their particular requirements, right, require them to file this particular difference with ICAO. The United States has got pages and pages of differences with that file. In fact, I think as a country, they're probably the least compliant with ICAO of the lot. Right? But they've got their own way of conducting their operations, and they do that. It's not a bad thing to file a difference. Right? It's just we believe that as a basic policy, we should try to file as few differences as possible. I'll give you an example of filing of a difference. International aviation requires that all aircraft of a certain seat capacity and a certain weight must have armored doors fitted to the cockpit. Now, in South Africa, because the perceived security threat is a lot less than it is in other parts of the world, we, for domestic flights, do not require those aircraft to have an armored door. When they fly internationally, they have to have an armored door. But, for example, there's certain airlines flying within South Africa or within the region that don't have armored doors into the cockpit. So there we find a difference. And we may continue to find a difference with ICAO in this regard. And we find that many, many states will do that for their domestic situation. That's an example. But we can certainly forward you the page of the differences that have been filed. Right. The second question was our relationship with ATNS. As a regulator, we regulate ATNS, much as we regulate all of the airport operators, obviously, which includes AXA as well. They are required to conform to the specific group regulations regarding to training and licensing for air traffic controllers, and it's done really in international terms as well. We have a very good working relationship with ATNS, in fact, with AXA as well. And we certainly hope with the moving on of the previous CEO at ATNS that the relationship will continue. And there's absolutely no reason why it shouldn't. So we have a very good working relationship with ATNS. But again, we are the regulator. And when and where it might be necessary for us to request compliance from them, we will do that. We do exactly the same with AXA. We had a situation with conducting an inspection the other day. A specific security point. It had been noted in the previous inspection that had taken place. It hadn't been rectified. I called the CEO directly. Literally within hours, that had been fixed. And this is the sort of relationship that we have and that we will continue to have.
Okay. Then there were a couple of questions from different people, but all relating basically to shortages or the challenge of departures, which you seem to have done much better on since we last reported. That was the big problem.
I must say, with regard to recruitment, we've actually done extremely well. We've been able to attract engineers from organizations such as SAM Technical. SAP Air, when they showed the operation of other engineers, became redundant. So we in fact advertised for the end of last year for 19 technically qualified people to train as inspectors. We received about 95 applications.
Okay.
So from that point of view, we didn't have a problem. We can get enough pilots to train as inspectors, but we just battled to get those with specific qualifications.
That's true.
So we're not having a problem attracting people to the CAA. In fact, our turnover rate right now is pretty good. With regard to retention plan, we've just submitted a retention policy to the board, and that is still in the process of being sort of done in retrospect. But the CAA's remuneration policy is pretty good. We're in the upper third of the market in the aviation industry, and therefore when we do advertise, we find that we get pretty, pretty highly qualified people.
It was certainly something we emphasized when we met last with the CA, that we said, you know, it's not a large staff you're talking about. And it's so, I mean, the potential losses to the country, if there are serious problems in the far outweigh, and we also urge that on the department, I mean, to be up there in terms of salaries in order to retain professional requirements. We would strongly support
that. We're going
to
have to push it up as well, for example, to get those few pilots that are specifically qualified, and we are going to have to push it up towards the applicants.
Good.
Fortunately, we've taken them into account in our budget.
Good. No, we would welcome.
Okay. Customer satisfaction, we have a specific section which is customer relations. We have got a major website in South Africa called AFCON. We participate in that on a daily basis. Anybody can post queries through that particular website directly to our customer relations staff. We have seen a remarkable improvement in the attitude of, when I talk about industry, the people that we regulate, the ones that come and get licenses, that come to us for airworthiness certificates for the aircraft, for registration of the aircraft, a marked improvement in the service that we're doing, and a significant reduction in the delivery time of, for example, the registering of the aircraft and getting approvals and all of the other things that go with it.
There was an issue about the regularity of inspections, basically.
Yes, how do we choose? We have a master surveillance plan. Right, so for every single operator in the country, and for every single maintenance organization, we have got a big spreadsheet. They transfer that to a board on a monthly basis as well. We know exactly who we're going to be auditing at any point in time during the year. And that's done on an annual basis. We've done all of the 10 major airlines already this year. I'll give you a difference in inspection. We were talking about SA, maybe it's going to get a little bit easy. Typically, we would send about 6 inspectors to SAA for a week to look at the operational side, not the technical side, the operational side. This year, in March, we sent 22 inspectors for a period of 2 weeks to go and conduct the inspection. Part of the findings that both ICAO and the FAA had against the CAA was that they'd been conducting inspections against SAA for many years. And I was running the department, so I was very happy. We wouldn't get any findings. They'd come and they'd say everything's working fine. Both the FAA and ICAO said that's ridiculous. There's no airline that's working. You have to have findings. And therefore, we particularly went in strength. Right, and when I say we said 22, 11 of those were in training, doing on-the-job training as well. So there was a large inspectorate. In fact, my brief to the inspectors was, you better go and find it. So if you can't find anything, call me, I'll tell you where to find it. You know, so no, we concentrate on making sure that our standard is even, and that in fact we cannot have any of the operators pointing at us. I will, for the sake of this committee, if we can do it, in I believe if we do have parliamentary protection or privilege, I'll just mention that. Nationwide, early in the year, was unhappy with the rate that the aircraft could be released back into service. At the time of them going to liquidation, 11 of their 17 aircraft to come back into service. And CA in particular is very concerned about the rate, and in fact was making allegations that the CAA was slowing the process. We assured them that we weren't, that as and when SATAIR, that had been contracted to do their maintenance, was releasing the aircraft, we would send inspectors out in 24 hours, which would only be anybody else. We would send inspectors out in 24 hours to go and do a full certificate of airworthiness check on the airplane, and if it passed, get the certificate and off and go and fly. If it didn't pass, they'd have to fix the things that were wrong and then present it again the next day or 2 days after that. We received a delegation from Nationwide, which included a senior counsel and three lawyers, in which they wanted to take us on. We had our legal team involved. We had our whole evidence department involved. We got a list of questions from Nationwide saying exactly what it was that they wanted to discuss with us. They made their presentation. We gave our official response to that. And we were able to show in writing every single instance, including the original incident that happened, right, that the findings that were made were concrete and were in fact factual evidence, and that there was no delay in releasing their contract service, and that the whole reason that this was caused was the fact that that the original maintenance plan was set back, and that sadly we were doing it right, and that's what was taking time. And that was the beginning of
Okay, thanks for that. Okay.
That was the gist of my question, Chair. I mean, is SAA compliant? Have they got enough people? Surely there should be so many technicians per aircraft on the maintenance site so that you then can...
We haven't conducted the audit yet on the SAA technical, but as part of the operator audit that we did, the operator is also responsible for maintenance, and they have the vision within the operations side, and that used to be my responsibility a number of years back at SA, was to ensure that SA Technical, right, does the correct maintenance on the aircraft. And we had a finding that we were very concerned about the huge turnover of staff. One of the reasons that it hasn't been flagged as a major safety concern is that SA shut down one of its major production lines, their maintenance lines. They were doing maintenance for airlines like Lufthansa, Saudi Arabia. A lot of airlines from around the world were coming having heavy maintenance down in South Africa. That line was shut down at the demise of the 747, which meant that a lot of technicians in fact were redundant. So we weren't concerned at that point in time. We did raise it as a finding, saying that if it continued, we would find it to be a major problem. The FAA conducted an independent audit because SAA Technical is licensed as an FAA repair station, which means that any aircraft that is American registered can be repaired at SAA. It's been like that for many, many years. They conducted an audit about a month after us and did exactly the same thing.
Okay. In the interest of time, there's the issue on the CEO commissioner issue, which would be awkward for you to answer. Maybe you could ask Kenny and then there's one other thing which relates a little bit to what we've just been dealing with, which is, I mean, I think a number of us who travel, and we all travel a lot on plane, noticing what seems to be a pattern of increasing delays from SAA. Some of it might have to do with handling the new handlers, and we'll maybe talk about that when we get to AXA. But some of it does seem to be of a technical nature. Certainly, I've been on several flights lately, and there seems to be a pattern of increased delays. Are we right? Is that just anecdotal from us? Is it just anecdotal from, you know, an anecdotal impression, or would you?
No, certainly while I was here at SAA, as I said, we monitored on a regular basis. We did notice an increase in the number of technical delays, caused by a number of factors, I would say. One was going through the restructuring process that SA went through and having to reduce its operating costs by some 20-30%. One of the points that is, one of the things that is very expensive for any airline or any maintenance organization is the amount of stock that they carry on the shelves. You can imagine with a range of aircraft that SA operates, to carry spares for every single part on the airplane, I mean, there's millions we're talking about. parts that, have to be carried in the stores. No airline does it. Right. SAA would typically carry more spares than, for example, an airline based in Europe, because if you're based in Europe, you can get from dozen sources close by. SAA has to wait for somebody to come from overseas. But once the accountants get involved, right, they come in and they do an audit, and the audit was done by an independent company to say that the stock holding at SAA Technical was too high. And this was a major cause of the high cost of maintenance. Right, so, I mean, get involved, and what they do is they say, right, we'll reduce that down to a level which is the international norm. But certainly, because of the fact that we have got this one supply chain,
our distance isn't the international
norm. Instead of getting the part from a store down the road, you have to order it from Europe and then you come the next day. Now, if I just say, if there's any reason for that, it would be related to that type of exercise. And that again, together with possibly technicians being fast tracked to a large degree as well. Where previously individuals would have years and years and years of experience in the hangar before they would go out into the line. Now, when you're on the line doing the line maintenance, that's where you troubleshoot. You find something wrong. For example, the radar screen's not working or something, right? The technician goes in there, he's got 10 minutes before the passenger's aboard there, but you fix that. When you have people that are highly experienced, they've done this hundreds of times, they don't have to go through the book. They will use their experience to say, I've had that before. It's this problem. Pull out the part, replace the part, fixed. When you have people that don't have that sort of years and years and years of experience, they have to go through the book, so they go through a troubleshooting procedure.
Okay. So you've given us a flavor of what might be some of the factors. Thank you for that. Can we then quickly look at the issue of CEO and Commissioner?
Thank you, Sir Chairman. Just want to the question with regards to the Commissioner and the CEO. One must bear in mind that our Aviation Act is close to 5 decades old. In the Aviation Act of 1962, that spoke about the Commissioner at that stage. And then in 1998, the Financial Conservation Act came about, which brought into play the CEO as such. Now, the Aviation Act allows for the Commissioner to decide and take action, suspend whatever, in the interest of aviation safety. The South African Conservation Act of 1998 allows the CEO to get a appeal as such. Now, if you combine both the posts, in terms of our administrative act, you can't suspend the person in the same token, wear the same hat, and then get an appeal. So that's where you get your first legal challenge. Okay? Over and above that, in terms of orders, both with ACAIO and FAA, what they found is that the Civil Aviation Act has the CEO, who is responsible for aviation safety. He reports to a board who is accountable for aviation safety, and the board reports to the minister as such. Whereas the Aviation Act has a commissioner who is also responsible for safety, and the commissioner is appointed by the minister. So there was a conflicting amount of roles played by one person in the various acts. And as you rightfully pointed out, industry norm currently is to consolidate all those various positions into one person, and allow one person to be totally accountable for civil aviation safety and security for a particular country. And one has to look at the FAA model, which is on the internet for public consumption. It clearly outlines that it should be a very clear reporting line of having one person responsible for civil aviation safety accountable to the governing board of the country.
Okay. That's just a taste of the issue. Obviously, this is one of the key things we'll be looking at when we get round to the legislation. Hopefully soon.
It's actually closing for comment today, but tomorrow, sir.
Okay, good. So that's good. Okay, sorry to have rushed a little bit, but obviously I'll be in trouble with that, sir.
That's
what I wouldn't. Okay, yes. Because we're using it a lot.
Not we Singapore nationwide and other airlines.
Okay, thanks very much. Thanks to our colleagues. Thanks to Duke. And very nice to meet you. Thank you for a comprehensive report. Sorry, you know, we would like to have more time, obviously, but we get
to. Has he said that their new head office is going to be next to Kinshasa?
No, he didn't. In fact, we're going to hear about Kinshasa now.
He has a vision for this mid-range for your accounting, but I think we can move it to
Okay. Good. Okay, thanks very much.
Could you excuse us?
Yes, of course.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the members.
Sorry? Is there something outside? Can I allow members to... I'll have a revolt. Can I allow members to... 5 minutes... Yeah. Bring the stuff back so we can...
Work in
lunch. Yeah. Bring it longer. They told us you'd be long and they would be very long. But you're not going to be that long. I know this is fairly short. Let's go to 2 minutes. So thank you. No, we have to... Yeah. Yeah. This is not briefing. I have read it, yeah. So. You know, we're more than we're not accountants. Yeah, you know, we're not shareholders. Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you. How are you? I'm all right.
Okay.